Hello, I'm Kyle Willoughby, and joining me is
Claire White.
Hi.
And this is Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures, a Nerd Manual. We're here to discuss new nerd creations, how they were made, and explore the roots of the characters and the stories. Today, we're talking about No Man's Sky, which is a video game that was released on August 9th of this year, 2016. Why is this game important, Claire?
It was probably one of the most anticipated games of the year. I think between this and Pokemon Go were the two biggest games of the summer.
A lot of hype behind No Man's Sky. It's a space exploration game with over 18 quintillion explorable planets. The object of the game is to get to the center of the universe, and you do this by mining elements off of planets and essentially pimping out your ship so that it can, you know, go faster and farther than
the
ones you had before.
And eventually hit dead center.
This game has been talked about a lot. One of the creators was featured on The Tonight Show.
With Stephen Colbert. Actually, it's The Late Show.
Whatever. Late, tonight. They're both at night.
That's cute.
Claire will be telling us about the production of the game, which it was made by Hello Games, and they're a small indie studio, right?
Right, but it got a PlayStation release.
Which is a big deal. And I will be talking about the science fiction authors that influenced this game, at least according to Sean Murray and the creators of No Man's Sky, and then the science fiction specific author who I think really, really influenced this game. So the creators, and when I say the creators, I mostly mean Sean Murray. More people work on this game, but he's the one who's the most vocal about it.
He's the head creator, spokesman for the company.
Yeah, yeah. He's been name dropping some pretty big science fiction authors. Like at E3 in 2014, when they released a trailer to the game, he mentioned Isaac Asimov and Robert Heinlein. He's also mentioned how Star Wars obviously has influenced him because it
influences anything sci-fi.
Dune by Frank Herbert, which is a book written in the 60s, heavily influenced this game, he says. And as I said before, I call it the Holy Trinity of science fiction authors, but it's Isaac Asimov, Robert Heinlein, and Arthur C. Clarke.
Okay.
Ian M. Banks gets a mention every now and again as regards to this game. I don't feel that his books really speak that much to No Man's Sky, but that's a personal opinion. The author of all those ones that Murray mentioned that really stands out in my mind as having a big part of No Man's Sky is Mr. Arthur C. Clarke.
Okay, and why is that?
Arthur C. Clarke wrote 2001: A Space Odyssey is probably his most famous book.
I think most people have heard of it.
Yeah, it was made into a movie directed by Stanley Kubrick.
At the same time, right?
At the exact same time as the book was released. Yeah, they kind of did it in conjunction, and that was in 1968. Now, 2001: A Space Odyssey, there's a lot of themes to it. Specifically, what I picked up on in comparison to No Man's Sky is kind of the theme of space travel in itself. Now, you've seen the movie, right, Claire?
Yes.
How kind of the lonely monotony of space travel almost.
Right. That's kind of the center point of both this movie, the 2001 Space Odyssey movie, and the video game.
And the video game No Man's Sky.
Is that you're supposed to be fascinated with
just being in space.
Mm-hmm.
These shots of being in space and this adventuring to another planet or another moon. In 2001 A Space Odyssey, they're going to one of Jupiter's moons.
And the novelty of it.
Yeah, yeah. Another big part, and it's not really a theme, but it's definitely a presence in both 2001 A Space Odyssey and No Man's Sky, are monoliths.
What are monoliths, Kyle?
So it's a hard word to say. It's it's essentially just a geographical feature. It's just a big rock, normally, that juts out of nowhere, kind of by itself.
So maybe Stonehenge?
Stonehenge, you could say those are monoliths, those big giant stones. There's a lot of monolith geography in the western United States.
And it's normally one.
Yeah,
right?
It's normally one just hunk of something that sticks out over kind of a plain, like a flatter area.
Right, and it doesn't have to be natural. It can be man-made.
It doesn't have to be
not even man-made. It can be creature-made.
Yeah, yeah. So in 2001 A Space Odyssey, monoliths are alien technology that impart knowledge onto humans and help progress the human race. And in No Man's Sky, the monoliths are, once again, these ancient alien structures that impart knowledge onto you, the player.
Right.
And they kind of give you the lore of the universe, of that No Man's Sky world, like what is going on and why they're here.
Yeah, I feel like if there's any sort of direction in No Man's Sky, a lot of it has to do with interacting with the monoliths.
Yeah, yeah. The other Arthur C. Clarke story I wanted to mention was a book called Rendezvous with Rama. Now, this is a story about an alien spaceship that comes hurtling through the solar system. Earth sees it and is like, whoa, what's that? It's an alien ship. We got to send people to check it out. A team of astronauts goes inside this alien ship to see what it's all about. They find abandoned cities and half robot, half biotic sort of creatures that don't really interact with them, that just kind of ignore them. And the ship essentially is just passing through. Like, it doesn't stop at Earth.
We don't matter.
We don't matter. And it's this theme of unexceptionalism of the human race, where a lot of sci-fi, it's like, there's the galactic empire of the humanoid species, or like, we're being invaded by some other and we triumph over this.
We're fighting back.
It's this theme that Arthur C. Clarke, I think, definitely explored a lot, which is, we're insignificant in the grand scheme of the universe.
Yeah, and in No Man's Sky, you are definitely insignificant.
In No Man's Sky, I definitely felt insignificant a lot of times playing that game. One more thing about Arthur C. Clarke I wanted to mention is the alien geometry that he really incorporates into his stories that I see a lot in No Man's Sky, how the ships are kind of like these geometric shapes. Everything seems very... I don't want to keep using the word geometric, but very, like...
Mathematical?
Mathematical, yeah, yeah. And in Arthur C. Clarke's stories, like, the monoliths are described of having a 1-4-9 ratio, which, in other words, it's the squares of the first three positive integers, which create this, like, perfect structure, essentially.
I'm going to nod and say that makes total sense to me.
And then in Rendezvous with Rama, the ship is a giant cylinder, 20 kilometers in diameter and 54 kilometers long, that spins. And so it gets centrifugal force and creates anti-gravity inside it through its spinning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which I thought, not anti-gravity, creates gravity inside it through its spinning.
So it's all about, like, mathematically being very specific.
Yeah, yeah. And just these, like, very geometric shapes, like a perfect cylinder.
Right.
I feel like you see that in No Man's Sky.
You do.
So No Man's Sky obviously is kind of pushing the limit of video games right now.
I'll get more into that later.
Claire's going to get more into that either.
That's a big part of the hype.
Yeah, yeah. And it's kind of fitting that it's like this sci-fi game pushing scientific limits in its own.
Going where no game has gone before.
Except that there is a game that was very similar to it that came out in the 80s, just on a much, much smaller scale. And this game is called Elite. Now, Elite was a video game, came out in 1984 for the BBC Micro and the Acorn Electron computers, which, I'll be honest, no idea what those are.
Me neither.
I imagine they just look like old 80s computers.
Yeah, I imagine they're like as big as a desk.
Yeah. So Elite was one of the first home computer games to use the wireframe 3D graphics. I don't know if you guys ever played much of the old Asteroids. But essentially, you just had these kind of blue lines that created 3D structures with no filling in between them.
You know what I'm picturing right now?
What?
DOS.
In essence, Claire, yes. Also, they were very geometric, kind of going back to the Arthur C. Clarke space geometries a little bit.
I mean, Sean Murray says Elite was a big inspiration for him, and he played it as a kid.
Yeah, and it's clear. So in Elite, you command a spacecraft, and you commence making money through asteroid mining. Sounds a little familiar.
Definitely do that in No Man's Sky.
If you play No Man's Sky. Military missions, which are another thing you can do in No Man's Sky.
Haven't gotten there yet.
Trading at space stations.
Definitely do that in No Man's
Sky. A lot of No Man's Sky. Or piracy, which you, once again, can do.
Haven't done it.
And No Man's Sky. Yeah, I'm afraid to pirate.
I get nervous.
I feel bad. I should, though.
I feel like that's you.
Who doesn't want to be a space pirate? So anyway, in Elite, you would jump to different star systems, which all contained planets, and each planet had a space station above it. Now, you couldn't go on to these planets, but you would mine asteroids and go to the space station and get missions from these space stations.
Sounds like an awesome game.
It is pretty cool. It's, graphically, it's
from the 80s.
Below our standards now.
No, but it's from the 80s.
From the 80s, but it was very revolutionary. Now, one of the coolest things about this game, I think, was that it included a novella by a guy named Robert Holdstock called The Dark Wheel, which gave background into the universe and insight into the moral and legal codes of that world.
Oh, whoa.
Which, honestly, would have been really helpful and cool for No Man's Sky,
you know what?
I
feel like it's coming out for No Man's Sky. I think they're just going to, Beyonce-style, drop that.
Well, they did some, they've actually done some comics with it. With Dave Gibbons, who did the artwork for Watchmen.
That was super cool.
Other things. Yeah. So there are some stories that will exist in this world, but it still would have been nice to kind of have that at release as like maybe a little explanation as to what's going on.
Even pre-release, it would have been a good lead-in.
Yeah. Now, Elite has been hugely influential on a ton of games, including Grand Theft Auto. The creators of Grand Theft Auto mentioned Elite is like this kind of open world game that really inspired them.
Oh, wow.
Because it was one of the first open world games. EVE Online, which is another space adventure game. And obviously, we just mentioned No Man's Sky. Now, Elite contained 8 galaxies with a total of 256 planets, which is a lot.
That is a lot. No Man's Sky is just expanding.
So many more. And the last thing I wanted to talk about, which you have to mention because Murray talks about this a lot, are sci-fi book covers, like the art covers of old sci-fi books and how that influenced the art direction of No Man's Sky. Now, Murray mentioned specific artists such as Chris Foss, who did the covers for the Foundation series, which is Isaac Asimov's big series. He was also hired on one of the early attempts to shoot the movie Dune as art direction input.
Makes sense.
Yeah. The other artist Murray mentions is named John Harris, who did the covers for Arthur C. Clarke, who we mentioned before, a bunch of his books, and Orson Scott Card, who wrote Ender's Game, which is another big sci-fi book. He was also commissioned by NASA to paint the Endeavour space shuttle launch in 1984. So,
no way.
Yeah, so that's pretty cool. And finally, a man named Ralph McQuarrie, who worked on art direction and was an illustrator for a little thing called Star Wars.
And what made them all influential?
They kind of used this pastel sort of color palette with very fantastical images of alien landscapes. And they used a lot of hues of like oranges and browns and yellows.
It was very optimistic, right?
Yeah, it was very optimistic, but very foreign at the same time. Like they tried to make it look alien with mm-hmm. these kind of deserty landscapes, but not always deserty. Sometimes they would use like kind of a jungle planet look with greens and blues, but also always very pastel.
Right. We'll link to it on the Facebook page.
Yes.
And you can see exactly what we're talking about.
Yes. So that is what I have for history. Obviously, there's a lot more we could go into depth here, but we only have so much time. So, Claire, what can you tell us about the production of No Man's Sky?
No Man's Sky. Well, I'm going to start by talking about Hello Games and its trajectory to making No Man's Sky.
Yeah, because they're a small company, right?
Very small company. It was started in 2008 by 4 friends in Guildford in the United Kingdom.
Okay.
And all 4 people are still involved in the studio today. There's Sean Murray, who we've been talking about, Grant Duncan, David Ream, and Ryan Doyle. And they all left their jobs at big video game companies to come and make things that they were more excited about.
Okay.
And Murray says that when they started working together, he told them to consider their childhood source material. So what did you want to be when you were a kid? Did you want to be a paleontologist? Did you want to be an astronaut? That's what I wanted to be when I was a kid. And they wanted to make a game that was different, that hadn't really been done before. And the first game that they came up with was Joe Danger, and they were kind of also trying to bring back the fun to video games. And he was like a daredevil stuntman who was navigating a course. And it was pretty successful. And they followed it up with Joe Danger 2 in 2012. Now, also, this was before indie games were really big. This is 2010. And we take indie games as for granted.
Yeah.
But it's actually a fairly recent
thing. It's a fairly recent thing that indie games get much popularity at all.
Right. And they were a very small studio releasing this new game with, you know, not based on anything. And they couldn't find a publisher. And this is going to come up throughout my segment, but I have this idea of Sean Murray as like a tortured artist. And so what he did is that he sold his house to
keep the studio going?
To pay for the publishing of Joe Danger.
Oh, wow.
And he says that it was the good thing to do because he bought that house with money that he made working for EA, which is one of the top video game companies in the world.
Yeah, they're huge.
But he said it was dirty money. so we had to get rid of it.
That's really funny.
And to follow along with this tortured artist theme, he said he went through, he calls it a midlife crisis, which he's in his 30s. Fine. during the second show, Danger, because he was worried he was going to get stuck making sequel upon sequel.
Joe Danger forever.
Yeah, Joe Danger for life.
Yeah.
So he started developing No Man's Sky on his own and then later with a very small team within a very small studio. And he says with No Man's Sky, he was developing his ideal game, which was a space adventure like nothing anyone had ever seen before. And the idea he wanted to create of being, so we talked about being alone and insignificant, he traces back to his childhood in the Australian outback. He lived there for a while with his parents, and they had this huge ranch with a gold mine on it, and you could really only get there by plane.
Yeah.
And every morning they had to wake up and check the machines that kept them alive.
Yeah.
And he said he thinks it's the closest thing that you can get to feeling like you're on Mars, on Earth.
Being in the Australian outback.
Yeah.
I didn't know. I knew he had an accent. I knew he talked funny. I didn't know he was from Australia.
Well, he was born in England, lived in Australia, okay. And now he works in England. Okay. So it's probably a mix of everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he also wanted to evoke the emotion of landing on the planet and feeling like no one else had ever been there before.
Okay, yeah, kind of like paving the way, that like unclaimed ground. Very pioneery.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is that No Man's Sky has quintillions of planets.
Yeah.
So basically the way that they do this is that they made, to create all these planets, is that these planets are created by an algorithm, which is basically like a pattern that makes each planet a little bit different from everything else.
Yeah.
And to speed up this process, they invented these drones to go in and fix, like, keep an eye on the planets so they could fix the bugs. So basically, these in-game drones go to the planets, take GIFs of the planets, and then the creators look at those GIFs, and then they'll go in and fix it if it needs fixing.
Oh, okay.
Which is how you get a small team able to create this huge world is drones and algorithms.
Because a lot of companies use game testers for that. I have a buddy who was a game tester for Bethesda for a while, and he ran around Fallout 3 trying to find bugs. And he's like, yeah, I played that game a million times, but I hardly played it. I was like running into corners and things and seeing where I would get stuck.
Right. They use drones.
Which you would have to for something so big.
Right. And it's also, the worlds are generated by this engine, and it drops resources onto this world and then determines the animals that would live there. And they also invented an algorithm that scans the bone structure of an animal and then combines it with different heads, feet, necks from other species. And then the system alters the bone structure so that every animal looks like it was designed by hand.
Okay.
And they give it a voice to match the volume of their body. And they kind of just live their own lives and apparently even surprise the people who created the game.
I've seen some weird animals in that game, like these pineapple-looking things that kind of hop around.
Yeah, and like things that look like dinosaurs.
Yeah.
Well, they were saying that like they shot, like one of the video game developers like shot a bird out of the sky and it fell into the water, and then a shark ate the bird. And he was totally shocked that the shark ate the bird. It wasn't expecting it at all.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
The world really kind of operates on its own.
Yeah, and started to grow by itself.
Yeah, and they did change some things. Like, I guess the moons orbit closer than the planets and physics would actually allow. And they altered, like, the atmospheric particles so that they could make the colors different and make it more interesting.
And some of the elements in there are made up or are spelled slightly different than...
They created their own elements for
that's
this.
That's what it was. Okay,
And also, they say it's so interconnected. Like, minor adjustments to the game can make a mountain a lake.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I mean, it's so cool.
This is really cool.
And what they seem to be most proud of is that this game has no limits. Like, in most video games, for anyone who's played a video game, there's always that door that you can't go through, or you can't go past this mountain. In No Man's Sky, like, you see that star, you can go to that star.
Yeah.
You can walk around the planet if you want to.
It would take you forever, because these planets are humongous.
Or you could get in your, like, little starship.
And fly around it. But even then, I've been on planets, and I've been, like, in my starship to fly to a point, and it says, like, oh, while you're in the atmosphere of this planet, that's an hour away. That's 2 hours away.
Yeah. Also, the day-to-night cycle happens not because someone, like, is turning the clock. Yeah. Like, basically, like, oh, it's time. It turns to night now. Yeah. It's because this planet is moving around
orbiting
its sun.
A star.
Yeah.
Which is crazy.
And like you said, there's, like, a quintillion planets. And the thing about it is that, like you were saying about Elite, this actually takes some of the technology from Elite. It's procedural generation where the environments are created when you get there.
Okay.
And the reason Elite had it back in the day was because computers didn't have the memory that our computers have now.
They couldn't, yeah, they so needed to be generated.
You couldn't put
you
a whole
there.
Game onto the computer.
Yeah.
You had to, like, kind of create it as you went.
Yeah.
And this game is so big that you can't put this whole game onto the computer.
I can't imagine how much storage that would take, 18 quintillion full planets.
Right. So the thing is, if no one ever goes to one specific solar system, it'll never get discovered. It'll never get formed. These planets evolve as you get there.
Yeah.
Though, like, you can eventually run into a planet that someone else has created.
It's rare.
It's very rare. Well, I'll get to that. So that's the mechanics of the game, as I understand it. And it's a bit more complicated. Yeah, I was like, whoa, this is not my podcast. But now I also want to talk about the hype and the press surrounding it, because that's pretty much the reason we're doing this.
Yeah.
Is because this was one of the most highly anticipated video games of 2016.
And they're catching some shade, as the kids say.
They are. So I'm going to take it back to 2013. December 7th, 2013, at the VGAs, which is the Video Game Awards. And this is when the first trailer of No Man's Sky was presented.
Was released,
and the trailer is just Sean Murray playing the game. That was what their trailer was. And they were pretty much an unknown studio, Hello Games, and this trailer blew up. People freaked out. And Sean Murray said it was this thing of being, you know, unknown. And then after the VGAs, going to the airport and people asking him to take selfies.
Wow.
So, people were really excited about it. And at the time, there were only 10 people working at Hello Games. There's not much more now, but that's how small it was. And then what happened is that a few weeks later, there was a flood at their studio. And basically, it destroyed pretty much all of their work. MacBooks were floating.
That is terrible.
They had a lot of drawn images that they hadn't put on the computer yet.
Yeah.
Those were destroyed. So they had to throw everything away and start from scratch, which Murray said he thinks was a good thing. It kind of brought them all together. It made their, I had to make
focused,
their idea more cohesive.
Their product, yeah.
It's why they came up with a lot of the algorithms, because they had to find a way to create things faster.
Oh, okay.
But also, it took longer to release because of that. I mean, that happened in 2013. We're not getting the release till 2016.
Yeah.
And in between then and now, there has been so much hype. Like, we talked about it. He was on Colbert. There have been so many interviews, so many people talking about No Man's Sky between then and now. And people got really excited. And then it was supposed to release in June. And it got pushed back to August. Well, this is what happened. Sean Murray and Jason Schreier, who is the guy who reported it, both got death threats when it was announced that it was moving from June to August.
Yeah, people were going bananas about trying to, getting this game.
I mean, and death threats are insane.
That's insane.
They should never happen. But, also the idea is that the amount of death threats he was getting was crazy, considering that this is a game that no one had played. You didn't know what this game was. It wasn't like, oh no, my Crash Bandicoot sequel got delayed. I'm so angry. It's all I've been looking forward to.
And Naughty Dog, I will send death threats.
Don't say that.
Just kidding.
Just kidding. We're just kidding.
Just kidding.
And also, it wasn't crowdsourced.
Yeah.
So no one had any money invested in it.
It wasn't like, you had nothing to do with this. Shut up and just wait for this game.
I'm trying to give you a sense of, the hype around this game that was made by an independent studio of 16 people. And, the big boys, the big PlayStation releases, the Xbox and Nintendo releases, they have people laboring for years.
Years.
Many, many, many more people.
Huge teams.
Yeah, laboring for years to create this game. So when it released, it was Steam, which is a computer. It's basically a system that allows you to access computer games on it.
Yeah.
It was Steam's most successful launch of the year so far, until Civ 6.
Until Civ 6 comes out, we'll see.
And it was the second biggest PlayStation launch behind Uncharted of 2016, which we discussed in an earlier podcast.
We did.
It holds the fifth spot overall for a new franchise on Sony consoles, and then that's behind games like Destiny, Watch Dogs, The Last of Us, which were big,
big deals. Yeah, all those are really big games.
So in the first 2 weeks, they sold over 2 million copies.
It's a lot of copies.
It's a lot of copies. And then sales dropped 81% in the second week.
That's a lot of drop.
It's a lot of drop. Now, some drop is gonna, some drop is going to happen.
Yeah.
Right? You know,
yeah.
People are really excited. They buy it right away.
Yeah.
And then the people who are excited have already bought it.
Yeah, so it's going to, you know.
But this is kind of telling. It went from 157,000
daily players.
But daily players to 10,000 daily players in 10 days.
Yeah.
So people just lost interest.
Yeah.
And there was also this thing where the Sean Murray had made all these promises. There's actually a Reddit forum dedicated to things that Sean Murray had promised that didn't actually happen.
Like broken promises of No Man's Sky.
Oh, God. Like, he teased, like, oh, you'll never know what you look like unless you meet someone else. But that would never happen. And then the first day, two players met, arranged a meeting, and couldn't see what the other looked like.
Yeah. That sucks. I guess he thought it would never happen, or...
Yeah, and Sean Murray was like, oh, I'm just shocked that people met.
Yeah.
And then the PC release was delayed for a few days, and then when it did get released, it had all
it's
these
really
buggy... And, like, the No Man's Sky on my console...
Yeah, we play it on PS4.
PS4 shut down at one point. So it's a really buggy game, which for a full-priced $60 PlayStation game is pretty unacceptable.
Yeah, that's... It's hard to justify the full price of it when it's coming out so buggy.
And I didn't mention this earlier, but this is being released by Sony as a Sony game. So they're charging $60 as opposed to most independent games, which would be released at like $20 to $30.
$20 to $30, and you can just kind of download it normally on right on.
People are buying this game expecting the quality of that they would get from the $60 games that Sony releases their biggest, best titles on.
Yeah.
So I think this is a good segue. Kyle, was it worth the $60?
That's a loaded question, Claire.
Is it?
I think it should have been a $30 game as far as enjoyment. I mean, if you're looking at like bang for your buck, like $60 for 18 quintillion planets, it seems like a good deal, except when the game starts to get samey.
Yeah, it's very... We talked about how it's a lot of mining and building spaceship parts and then going to the next thing. It becomes very monotonous after a while.
Yeah, it's...
After a while, after 30 minutes.
There's, you know, when you're looking at video games, there's a whole reward system. There's like a system of carrots and sticks and like what it's making you... The fulfillment of getting an award. Like when you play these shooter games and you're like, oh, 5 headshots with a sniper rifle, you get the award. And you're like, oh, it feels a little good.
Or you're trying to get to past this level.
Yeah, yeah. And that's...
To get past the next part of the story.
Yeah.
Or
and that's your reward.
Yeah.
And in this game, the rewards are very small. It's like, in the beginning, they seem big. You know, you fix your ship. Oh, I fixed my ship. Now, your reward is now you have your ship. You can fly.
You can go to another planet.
But after that, it just starts getting like, okay, I need plutonium to refill my ship. Okay, I need to get this item to make the warp drive. Okay, I need to get this. And it's just very much the same game over and over and over and over again.
Yeah, and to be fair, they do interject parts of mythology. And there you can learn different alien... languages, like you build that over time, and your relationships with the aliens you can build over time, but it's all very face value.
Yeah, none of it felt that fulfilling. The most fulfilling part in that game still for me is, even though a lot of the planets start to seem the same, is still taking off a planet and then flying to a new planet, checking out something else.
Yeah, I only played for a few hours, and part of this I know is me. I'm not great with the PlayStation console.
Yeah, I remember watching Claire play, like, her suit is being killed by radiation, and she's like, what do I do? Where do I go?
And I'm, like, trying to walk into the ground because that's the way I'm facing. I mean, that aside, I got so bored. And I felt bad because I wanted to play more, but I did watch a lot of it being played.
Yeah.
But I just didn't have the heart to keep going for myself. I get so...
Yeah.
And... He was like, mine, build this, mine, build that. And yeah. I couldn't quite see where it was all leading to.
Yeah, I was setting myself goals in that game. For my first goal, get a sweet new ship, not the dumb one you start with. And I was trying to get money to get that sweet new ship, and I got it. And I was like, yeah, new ship. Awesome. This one looks like, you know, looked kind of like the Viper from Battlestar Galactica, except a little pokier. And I was like, oh, I got my new ship. Next goal, find a planet that isn't trying to kill me. Because every planet I seemed to find was hostile.
Yeah.
And I went to like 7 different systems, still couldn't find a planet that was trying to kill me or that wasn't trying to kill me. And I just kind of got lost and lost sight of like the enjoyment of the game. Like it just, the rewards just weren't enough for me.
You said you also had an emotional reaction to the game.
Okay, yeah, this is on a slightly different note with this game. I had like, it's a very lonely game. It's very lonely and it is very beautiful. One of its strongest suits is landing on a undiscovered planet and just looking at this landscape as the sun sets or whatever and just seeing. One of my favorite planets, honestly, became the ones that had like almost no atmosphere and were very rocky because there was just something like very beautiful, deserty about it. And it's a really lonely game. I would play it at night by myself after my girlfriend had gone to bed with like this 65 Days of Static soundtrack, which is a really lovely soundtrack too. And it was meditative almost. But it makes you feel very small. And while playing this game, I kind of had this like existential crisis while I was looking around for like whatever plutonium or what, I forget what element I needed. And I was just like, I'm alone. Everyone's alone. There's nothing. My whole life is just me wandering around trying to find different elements.
Trying like, to find plutonium.
And the modern day, you know, the real world equivalent of plutonium. And I just had this breakdown. I was like, what am I doing with my life? What is in this game? I blame this game for being so.
I think Sean Murray would be really pleased with your reaction.
Yeah.
I think that like he's trying to evoke that.
Yeah. I felt so small. I remember going with a friend and camping in Glacier National Park and looking up at the sky. And, you know, her and I were just kind of sitting there and we didn't really talk much. We just kind of absorbed the environment. And there's a niceness to feeling small and feeling insignificant, I think.
But this wasn't nice.
Well, this was nice for a while, but I was there, you know, I was just doing it over and over and over again. And it, I don't know, it kind of wore on my psyche.
Yeah, I got scared. I didn't want to play it alone. Like, I wanted to have my boyfriend sit on the couch with me.
Just in case.
Like, you can be on the computer, but I need you here
as
moral support.
Yeah.
When I'm playing this. I'm really here. There's a lot of talk about what this will do for independent games. Because this is the first time an independent game has been released as an exclusive, like, Sony. Well, not first time exclusive, but the first time it's been released as like a full Sony title
with the
price tag and the publicity. And while Sony has made a ton of money off of this, I think this game would have done better if it had no hype.
Yeah.
It was just released and people hadn't built up their expectations around it. And Sony hadn't built up their expectations around it.
Yeah. No, and that's the thing. It had a 3-year long hype train. Where for 3 years you're waiting for this game and you're getting more and more excited about it. Whereas a company like Bethesda, which makes the Fallout games and the Elder Scrolls games, you know, they'll come to E3, they'll have a big conference where they release a trailer like, boom, new Fallout, coming in 4 months. And it's like, oh yeah, cool. And those games are known to be buggy when they're released, but people don't care.
Yeah, they're kind of expecting it anyway.
Yeah, you have less time to build up this hype that it's going to be the perfect game. And I think part of No Man's Sky was that in people's heads it turned into something that it wasn't.
Right, and also Sean Murray has said multiple times how Sony was so great to work with because they were very hands-off about the whole process. But I think that if Sony had had its hands in it, it might have been...
You think it would have been a better game?
Yeah, I do. I think they would have... Well, it might not have been... They might have been like, I don't think Sean Murray would have worked with Sony if Sony had put their hands in
it.
But they might have forced more of a story, more reward, because they know how to make video games and they're all about customer happiness and satisfaction.
The fan service. Sony's all about giving the fans what they want. Whereas this game was definitely, I will say it's a cool game and I think it's cooler than it is fun, but it's more of an art game, if that
tortured
exists.
Artist. That's what I was saying.
Yeah.
It's this artist vision.
Yeah.
I do think it's going to pave the way for so much. I think that someone's going to see it, take this concept,
and just improve upon it.
Yeah. It could be Hello Games.
Thank you all so much for listening. Once again, I'm Kyle Willoughby.
And I'm Claire White.
And we are Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures, A Nerd Manual. Feel free to contact us on our website at dsrapodcast.com. We would love it if you could rate and review us on iTunes, and you can find the show on Twitter at dsrapodcast. I can be found on Twitter at klex303, that's K-L-E-X-303.
I can be found at Along With Claire, that's C-L-A-I-R-E.
And you can find our producer, James, at James Fowey Jr. That's James Fowey, F-O-U-H-E-Y-J-R, on Twitter as well. You can learn more about No Man's Sky on our Facebook page, where we will post some of our show notes, and I'll post some of the artwork I was talking about from the old sci-fi books. Our producer, who is as hideous on the inside as he is beautiful on the outside, is James Fowey. Our logo is done by Patty Hyland, who is beautiful both inside and out. And our theme was composed by Pete Rowan, who you kind of have to make that judgment for yourself, I think. Once again, this is Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures, A Nerd Manual. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next week.